Welcome to This Week in Impact, where Impact Alpha founder and CEO David Bank and I break down three of the most interesting impact investing stories of the week. I'm Brian Walsh. It's Thursday, April 25th. Today we'll discuss how family offices have the opportunity to invest in the climate transition, why three leading foundations made for-profit investments in an OpenAI competitor, and the brouhaha over whether voluntary carbon credits should count towards a company's climate targets. Plus, break out the champagne glasses because we're toasting Impact Alpha's 10th anniversary. All that and more on This Week in Impact. Hi, David. Happy Earth Week. How have you been observing?
Well, it's Earth Week. It's also Climate Week SF, which means everybody's in town. There's events all around the town, and we've been scurrying from place to place as best we can.
Well, that's great, because that gets us to our first story. Trillions of dollars of additional investment are needed to reach climate goals in time. When looking for sources of capital that have maximum flexibility, with the capability to deploy fully commercial, philanthropic, and something in between, many eyes turn to those mysterious entities known as family offices. After all, there are globally more than 4,500 family offices, which manage $6 trillion in wealth. Now, Bruce McNamer of Builders Initiative made the case in Impact Alpha this week that we need to attract and unlock philanthropic and investment dollars from family offices to get them off the sidelines and into climate solutions. David, to start us off, can you briefly explain why family offices have maximum flexibility regarding the types of capital they might deploy?
Well, family offices, as you say, is something of a euphemism for, you know, maybe billionaires, although even smaller wealthy families have family offices that manage all of the tax and other kinds of issues there. And increasingly, they also have, as you said, philanthropic arms and even impact investing arms. And often the younger generation, sometimes the older generation, but often the younger generation in these families is keen to make an impact. And in this case, this is the family office of Lucas Walton. He's an heir to the Walmart fortune, a grandson of Sam, I think. And he's got Builders Vision. Builders Initiative is the philanthropic arm. They've also got S2G Ventures, which is a sort of venture capital arm, and an asset management arm as well. So the family office has grown up to have lots of capacity to do different kinds of investments. And of course, that makes it a natural for impact investing.
Now, what does it mean for them to be investing across the capital spectrum?
Well, that's exactly the point. Because it's their money, they're not they don't have the same kind of fiduciary duties to outside investors. So therefore, you could make a grant if that's the appropriate mechanism for, say, a research project by a nonprofit, or you could make a venture investment in a startup, or you could helping in other ways to catalyze investments into a fund by jumping in early before other investors do. So you can take more risks. You could accept lower returns in some cases. These families, of course, want to perform well, but one of the ways they might want to perform well is on impact.
When it comes to catalytic capital providers, while they are willing to, as you say, take greater risks or accept lower returns or come in earlier or be a little bit more patient and have that kind of flexibility, they often aren't impact agnostic, right? They have specific impact objectives that they're trying to reach. And that's when they will bring the maximum flexibility, when a certain investment or project kind of fits their impact thesis. So how do we kind of marshal all of the different shapes and sizes and variations of impact theses that all these 4,500 different family offices might have? And how do we kind of organize them into more coherent sources of capital?
Well, good luck, but
that's the trillion-dollar question. Yeah.
But they do, as you said, have the flexibility to invest across the spectrum. Each family will have different interests, as you say, and that's fine, and that's good actually, because it means that they'll specialize and focus on what the needs are in those verticals, and they'll see what those market building mechanisms need to be. So the one we keyed on in the brief this week was obviously climate investing. And, different than a few years ago, climate tech investing has kind of been very strong. But there's still parts of the market that need catalytic capital to build out market-based models that work. And people make note, of course, that, you know, climate adaptation has lagged behind climate mitigation as a category. And so there's a lot of things in regenerative ag or oceans and other categories that are still lagging in investment. There's a whole world of what people call first of a kind demonstration projects for certain technologies. So you've got it ready to go, but you've got to build a big plant that's capital intensive, and you can de-risk those kinds of things with guarantees and offtake mechanisms. So there's a, you know, as listeners of this podcast know, there's a whole range of levers that investors can pull. And as you said, what makes family offices particularly appealing as a capital source is that they're able to pull all those levers and think about it in a kind of holistic, comprehensive way.
I felt like the piece was almost like a calling card to inspire other family offices. And, you know, the old adage, if you've met one foundation, you've met one foundation. And I think it applies to family offices. If you've met one family office, you've met one family office. So how do we get the message out, if you will, to additional family offices to kind of come in and come on in? The water's nice.
Well, we've been tracking, you know, the movement. I would say that movement has been smaller than expected of the number of families, but Builders Vision and Lucas Walton's not alone. You know, we've had Diane Eisenberg from Kenny Arth on the calls and on the podcast over time. Of course, one of the sort of grandparents of this is the Omidyar Network of Pam and Pierre Omidyar, Spring Point Partners in Philadelphia, the Berwins family, RS Group in Hong Kong, Annie Chen's family. There's associations and networks of these. The Creo Syndicate is a sort of network of family offices. They've deployed something like $5 billion for climate and sustainability initiatives. The Impact is Liesl Pritzker and Ian Simmons, as folks might know, and Justin Rockefeller. They've got about 85 families. Tonic has been around for a long time, and they're a little looser network, but they've got something like 500 asset owners. So, you know, you mentioned, I think, 4,500. I would say it's still in the, you know, in the low range of those folks who are committed to impact, but it's not any longer just, you know, one or two examples. There's now a veritable movement.
All right, well, let's leave it there and let's take a quick break. When we come back, from family offices to foundations, we'll discuss how impact investments in the AI company Anthropic might strengthen responsible innovation in tech.
I'm Eric Carmen Gonzalez, Impact Alpha's Director of Subscription Growth. Ever feel like there's so much happening, it's hard to keep up? We hear you. That's why we created Impact Alpha Latin America, a monthly newsletter for impact investors who want to keep their eye on trends and investments happening in Latin America and the Caribbean. Follow the money and connect with agents of impact powering Latin America's impact economy. Visit our Instagram page at Impact Alpha and click on the link in our bio to sign up.
Now, David, three leading foundations, the Ford Foundation, Omidyar Network, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation, are betting on Anthropic as a counterweight to OpenAI, currently the AI industry juggernaut. They jointly announced this month for-profit investments, that's not grants, nor program-related investments, into the privately held Anthropic PPC company. David, this collective investment is relatively limited in size and does not afford any specific governance or voting rights. So you wrote about it this week in Impact Alpha. How are these three foundations thinking about how this investment is going to make an impact?
Well, as you say, it's very small. You know, OpenAI may be the leader, but Anthropic's no shrinking violet. They raised something like $7.3 billion last year. I think Amazon has invested something like $4 billion. At Google has invested $2.55 billion, and these three foundations together invested $7.5 million, not billion. So they are a small part of the cap table of Anthropic, but it is interesting that they took that stake and hope, you know, by force of sort of moral suasion to, as we said, get a seat at the AI table. And it's an interesting strategy. The you know, Mike Kubzansky at Omidyar Network was telling me that he thinks that philanthropy and impact kind of took a pass or missed a chance to influence the social media governance, as it were, you know, a decade or so ago, as that sort of wave overtook tech, and they don't want to miss this AI moment because it's even bigger and obviously more consequential. So they're hoping to have an influence just by being able to talk as shareholders of Anthropic about things like, you know, the alignment and the do no harm parts, but really other things like worker voice. You know, how do you deploy AI in big companies with workers having a seat at the table to talk about all the different impacts. Of course, you know, AI might eliminate some jobs, but you know, it could also be structured and organized to improve jobs and improve the productivity of workers, and then hopefully improve their pay as well.
So one of the things that's different about this from other kind of shareholder advocacy is most shareholder advocacy campaigns work by purchasing shares in already public companies and then trying to use that as a foot in the door to launch proxy battles or other campaigns to enlist fellow shareholders in whatever topic they want to focus on. But this is a private company, and so maybe that's a little bit different here as well, is trying to get a foot in the door of a private company before it goes public to have that proverbial seat at the table, because of course, as you noted, there are no governance rights or board seats involved with this.
Yeah, but just to be clear, it's not adversarial in any way. In fact, it's really to prop up or backstop the stated intentions of Anthropic itself. So Anthropic is kind of a unique proposition. The founders split off from OpenAI a number of years ago and incorporated themselves, as you said, as a public benefit corporation. They also have a long-term benefit trust structure. So there's a body that's not responsible for sort of the share price that sits above the board of directors and over time appoints members to the board of directors. So all of these are mechanisms to try to keep the company on the track that the company says it wants to be on, possibly from the countervailing effects of possibly big tech companies like Amazon and Google, as I mentioned. So this is not adversarial in any way. The intent is to backstop or support the forces already at work in Anthropic that want to put social benefit and avoidance of social harms at the center of that company. That's kind of Anthropic's whole calling card in the industry now. And so they do have, you know, a tiny stake, but they probably have some moral authority, as it were. And it's interesting how they got into this deal. It came about as a part of a bankruptcy auction of shares that had been held by FTX, which is the now bankrupt, you know, crypto exchange run by Sam Bankman-Fried. And out of that wreckage of that, some shares became available and the three foundations put their hand up. There were a number of others, maybe close to a dozen, that the Omidyar Network approached. Most of them couldn't get the approvals in place in time to meet the auction deadlines. And so these three came off with this small investment.
And that's kind of interesting to take a step back and think about the fact that these three foundations, in a very small way, are helping to make whole the creditors, namely the customers of FTX, the now bankrupt exchange. And this investment in Anthropic that FTX had made, as you said, actually may help go a long way towards making those customers of FTX whole.
Well, the sale of $884 million of that stock could go some way, as you say, and the contribution of this group of foundations is part of that, but it's a tiny part of that, and it wasn't that they all hastened to add not the intent of the investment. It was just an opportunity to get your hands on some shares of Anthropic, which is quite a hot company, and it'll be a good investment, presumably. But really, it's an impact investment. It is private, as you mentioned, but it's far from early stage. So it's somewhere between, you know, startup investing and public market investing in what's a very large and well capitalized private company.
I think this is an interesting approach because it's not saying investing in quote unquote impact companies necessarily, but it's investing in a whole new category of companies that have the potential to be truly transformative and getting in as close to the ground floor as possible to try to have an influence. And so instead of waiting for these companies to kind of grow and mature and exit to the public markets to then have some kind of skin in the game or way to have some kind of influence in some way to try to get out ahead of that. And I wonder if that's going to be a playbook that foundations and other impact investors are going to be able to marshal in the years to come and think about their investment strategies in a slightly different way.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, you know, this is a part of a strategy like that, to have influence on things that have impact, not that don't necessarily call themselves impact companies. And AI inarguably is going to have impact. But other foundations have done this in things like health sciences. And so there have been investments in sort of medical biotech technology that may not be pointed towards, say, neglected diseases in emerging markets, but for which that might be a good application of this broader health technology. So it's not dissimilar from other kinds of investments where you find companies that have impact potential, and impact investors can help steer them to those applications.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break, David. In this house, science is real, but are carbon credits a real way for companies to meet their climate targets? Plus, we'll take a look back at the first 10 years of Impact Alpha.
Every day, Impact Alpha uncovers stories that make a difference to impact investors. I am Zalema Beeble, Chief Operating Officer at Impact Alpha, here with a special reminder. Subscribers get the award-winning brief 5 days a week and so much more. Unlock exclusive coverage, get access to subscriber-only calls and Slack channels, plus search hundreds of jobs and internships at the Impact Alpha Career Hub. What are you waiting for? Subscribe today. Learn more at impactalpha.com/subscribe.
Louis Widal reported this week on a controversy in how companies calculate their net zero ambitions. A leading standards body has proposed a seemingly arcane change that could have major implications for the voluntary carbon market. The arguments pit activists against policymakers and big money donors. At issue, the proper role of the $2 billion voluntary carbon market in helping corporations meet their climate targets. David, there are a lot of moving parts to this issue. Can you break this down for us? And why are some people against the use of carbon credits in meeting climate goals?
Well, let's just cut to the chase here and say that what's at stake is the launch of something called the Energy Transition Accelerator. And this is a mechanism that has been debated for several years, championed by John Kerry, backed by the Rockefeller Foundation, backed by the Bezos Earth Fund, to allow countries, not just individual projects, but whole countries, to retire coal plants and to protect natural resources, rainforests and things, and be able to then sell carbon credits on the world market to both companies and to other countries. And the notion is that it's a way to transfer financing to emerging markets and developing countries and move the cash that they need to manage their own climate transitions. That's been a big bone of contention in all of these climate negotiations. How do we actually pay the countries where there are climate resources, rainforests, for protecting them, and also make good on, the loss and damage that they're suffering from climate effects. And this is a mechanism to transfer that kind of money. Now, the thing is, you got to be able to have a market for these carbon credits. And heretofore,
you need to have a buyer.
You need to have a buyer, and you need to stoke demand for these carbon credits. So carbon credits now on the voluntary markets, which is only a small part of the global carbon market, but the voluntary market that companies buy to meet their net zero pledges and to sometimes burnish their PR, sometimes to actually offset their emissions. It's something, they're going for something between like $2 and $12 a ton. That's not high enough to really accomplish this this wealth transfer, as I said, from the developed and polluting world to the less developed and possibly carbon saving parts of the world. And so the notion is, if more companies were buying more credits, the prices would go up as supply and demand kicks in. And so one notion is, allow companies to offset their indirect carbon emissions, so-called scope 3 emissions, we can get into what that is, by buying carbon credits. And one obstacle to that had been something called the Science-Based Targets Initiative, which is the organization we wrote about this week, which validates and mandates kind of the standards that companies can use to sort of account for their carbon footprint. And they had been against carbon credits. Carbon credits, you got to remember, there is a good project somewhere in the world, sequestering carbon in forests and whatnot. But when you buy that carbon credit, you're essentially buying the right to continue polluting. Some folks have argued against it sort of at the broad conceptual level. Others have argued against it as that, well, some of these projects don't actually measure up in terms of saving that much carbon. And so there's a quality question, which everybody has been trying to wrap their heads around and solve over the last few years. But this was seen as a way to, the critics saw it as a way to let companies off the hook. The proponents see it as a way to enable the transfer of corporate cash to developing countries that need to do carbon projects. So it's kind of a question of what problem you think you're solving with it. And I guess where I come down is, carbon credits are an extremely imperfect mechanism for accounting for carbon on corporate side. I mean, most, what we really want is companies to abate and cut their own emissions from their own operations, not buy their way out of it. On the other hand, carbon credits are an excellent way to fund very worthwhile projects in places that are very much resource constrained. We've had stories over the last couple of weeks on using carbon credits to pay for clean cook stoves and carbon credits to pay for solar irrigation. So the fact that you can sell the carbon, credit is one way that we're going to make this transition happen.
All right. Well, finally this week, allow us to gaze at our own navels. It was back on April 28th, 2014, when the team flipped the switch and ImpactAlpha.com went live. David, we've gathered some tape from the past 10 years of Impact Alpha. Help us walk through those early days.
Yeah, Brian, we've been here for a while. Here's Zulema on a podcast recounting the early merger that brought us together.
So we started Impact Space back in 2012 with a co-founder in grad school. And at that time, we got introduced to David Bank through a mutual investor that we knew. And David was looking for a data partner. And at that time, Impact Alpha was called Impact IQ.
The key breakthrough really came in 2017 when we launched the Daily Brief. We didn't know whether we could keep it going for 5 days a week, but I think we've put out something like 3,000 of them by now. About a year ago, we launched The Brief. It's a daily newsletter, but by virtue of being daily, it turned out that we just carved out this position in the industry. We just became their trusted news source. We set out to cover impact investing as a beat in the expectation it would become one, and of course it has. France Eagle, Monique Akin, and Kathy Clark have been doing their State of the Field roundup every year now on Impact Alpha.
We always wanted impact investing to go mainstream. It seems like it has. What now?
Yeah, thank you. First of all, can I just say how thrilled I am to be doing this with these two women and Impact Alpha? We look forward to this every single year.
Over the years, we've keyed in on a few key themes or beats in impact investing. One of them recently has been Muni Impact with the support of Kimberly Cornett and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I think some of our agent of impact colleagues have called the municipal market kind of the original impact investment. We believe that that's true and are really delighted for the reporting that your team is kind of bringing to this sector and thinking about how impact really, runs through the heart of it.
One of the developments we've been tracking for a long time has been the rise of gender lens investing. And we've been watching and learning with Joy Anderson and Jackie Vanderbrug and the late, great Suzanne Beagle around gender smart investing. Suzanne, as many know, died last year. We've been working with the folks at Heading for Change. Here's Samantha Anderson.
David has shared with me that Suzanne was actually known for being the person who attended the most number of agents of impact calls. So she would have been so excited to be here today to kick off our partnership with Impact Alpha.
A defining moment for all of us was the retrenchment during the pandemic. Like a lot of businesses, we thought we were going to have trouble keeping the lights on. But then the opposite happened. We became one of the gathering spots for people during lockdown. The Gin's Amit Bori joined us on our podcast way back in 2020.
Clearly, this crisis has laid bare some of the issues with our system. Inequality is playing a huge role in the way that this crisis is felt. And that will only increase as it spreads more to emerging markets that have much weaker health systems.
And that same year brought the murder of George Floyd. We were already leaning heavily into racial equity and racial wealth building as themes, another area that transcends impact investing. And after the murder of George Floyd, we hosted on our podcast some Black Agents of Impact for a pretty frank talk on the challenges. Here's Dimitri Duckett, formerly with Living Cities, now with Known Holdings.
It's a bizarre situation to be in. I have a 20-year-old son, so I have my own young Black male who thinks the world is his oyster and his dad pays for everything, who's out there, and I just don't know what to do. We're binational families, so he's in college now, like overseas and all of that, and I've always debated on like where he would be best off, because I am the globalist. Like having that Black American, you know, sort of ticket really means something in a lot of places, especially if you come from at least middle income families. And yet I'm so happy that I've not kept him here, because I've worried about his well-being, as all parents do with their kids. And yet now I see that I've been relieved of a certain element of the American tragedy on top of the American dream.
And we're very keen on what we've been calling the ownership economy, the notion that it's not just, you know, wages and pay, but it's actually ownership of assets, and in some cases, ownership of the companies that folks work on. Jack Moriarty, formerly with Ownership America, now with Lafayette Square, laid out how it can have a big impact.
I think there's been a realization that if you're going to focus on economic mobility and addressing economic disparity, equity ownership has to be part of that strategy. We really need to find what are the opportunities to broaden the distribution of equity ownership. And employee ownership happens to be one particularly powerful and bipartisan strategy of doing that.
Well, David, as Maya Angelou said, you can't really know where you're going until you know where you've been. Quickly, what's in store for Impact Alpha and for Agents of Impact?
We think the shared identity that our community has created, we call them Agents of Impact, as you said, and the narrative we're all building is more important than ever. You know, it's practical, it's solutions oriented, it's kind of optimistic without being naive. And I think people have rallied around that. You know, we're all counting down to 2030 and the sustainable development goals, and the long-term trends that we've been tracking are still in play, and we're still tracking them. We raised our own first outside financing last year. We're rolling out enhancements to our products. We're really beefing up our data and intelligence offerings, as well as our editorial. And we just want to be essential to folks who are, you know, essential to the impact, who are moving capital and moving capital markets to really tackle the big challenges, and to bring about you know, this better world.
All right, David, congratulations on the first 10 years, and here's to the next 10 and beyond.
Thank you, Brian, and thanks really to all the Agents of Impact who've helped along the way, both on the team and all around the space.
Indeed. Thank you all so much for listening to This Week in Impact. David, what's the best way for people to contact us with feedback?
Well, Brian, folks can reach you and me and Isaac Silk, our producer, at podcast@impactalpha.com.
Great. Now, if you liked what you heard, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen and share this with a friend or colleague. If you want to help out, be sure to rate us and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. Believe it or not, it really helps other people find the show. This Week in Impact is a production of Impact Alpha and part of the Impact Alpha Podcast Network, bringing you investment news for a sustainable edge. For more exclusive stories about the world of impact investing and sustainable finance, join other Agents of Impact by subscribing to Impact Alpha. Just go to impactalpha.com/subscribe for full access. Thanks, as always, to our producer extraordinaire, Isaac Silk. I'm Brian Walsh. We'll see you next week for more Impact.